Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Maria Armudian, host of the Scholar Circle, sitting in for Ian Masters, who's on a well-deserved vacation. In this hour, climate scientists say the climate is, quote, changing before our eyes, end quote. Will the International Conference on Climate finally take action to thwart more disasters? Then, is the fiscal cliff real, or is it a political tool to change the shape of government? Then, European countries are divided on the Palestinian statehood vote. What might the vote mean for the future of the conflict in Israel and Palestine? We have with us Bill McKibben. He is the best-selling author of numerous books, including The End of Nature and Earth. He's also the founder of 350.org, an environmental organization dedicated to solving the problem of climate change. Larry Schweiger also joins us. Larry Schweiger is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of the award-winning Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. Welcome to you both. Thank you both for joining us here.
Well, thank you. And what a pleasure to be on with Larry, too.
I'm so pleased to get you both together. Let me just say that to the beginning. I think what I'd like to begin with is the latest scientific reality is looking extraordinarily stark. There has been a lot of talk, particularly Bill McKibben, you've been talking about a so-called tipping point. And we're hearing some pretty scary numbers. Where are we with this so-called tipping point?
Well, I think there's never going to be like a tipping point past which everything is, you know, on one side of which things were good and on the other side of which everything's irredeemable. But we are starting to see signs from the natural world of a kind of amplification of the warming that humans have caused by pouring carbon into the atmosphere. There was a paper that came out a couple of days ago, a pretty depressing one, talking about the fact that permafrost in the Arctic now seems to be melting at a very rapid rate. More rapid than we had suspected. And that's very bad news because we don't have any way really of refreezing it. We melted it by burning all that coal and gas and oil, but as it melts, it then releases lots of methane and carbon into the atmosphere. And we don't have any way to dial back that thermostat. So the upshot is we're really to the point when we have to take action, when there's no room for messing around at the edges. We got to take tough action to leave coal and gas and oil in the ground now. And hopefully, things like Sandy or the drought or the melt of the Arctic this summer will begin to convince our policymakers to actually make a little policy for once.
Larry Schweiger.
Well, to add to what Bill said, and I completely agree with everything he just said there, but I think to add to that, PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is hardly a left-wing organization, assessed this situation. This is their fourth assessment, and they determined that we need to cut our total carbon emissions annually by about 5% a year till the year 2050. So they're talking about a very aggressive effort to dial down the carbon dioxide emissions that we're producing. And in order to do that, we need to have very bold and, frankly, dramatic decisions across not just the United States, but across the planet. And we need to find new ways to get there. And having annual conversations that lead to nothing is not the way to do that. We need to tie carbon targets to trade and put some teeth into a process that will actually work for the future.
Well, you've just given me two subjects to talk about. So I want to get into both these international conversations that do seem to go nowhere and also some of the policy issues. But there's one thing I wanted to do before we went there, and that deals with what some of the effects are. We did see Sandy, of course, and people are finally starting to get to be a little more alert about the possibilities of these extreme weather changes. But I think there are a lot of other changes people don't quite understand. Bill McKibben, why don't you tell us what some of these things are that we might face that are not getting covered in the news?
Well, look, here are the sort of huge-scale changes you can see going on. One, pretty much everything frozen on Earth is melting, and melting very fast, the cryosphere. Two, the oceans, our biggest thing on Earth, are acidifying very rapidly. The ocean is 30% more acid than it was 40 years ago. And there was a paper today saying that at current rates, it'll be 150% more acid than that by the end of the century, which is not good news if you happen to be some one of those creatures, at the bottom of the marine food chain. But then maybe the changes we see most on land are come from the fact that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. And that means the atmosphere is about 5% wetter than it was 40 years ago. That loads the dice for drought and for flood, and both of which we're seeing. And I think people are making the connections. I was just saying to someone a minute ago, the polling data shows that the number of Americans concerned about climate change has gone through the roof in the last 2 years. It's up about 74% of Americans, which is more Americans than you get to agree on almost anything. And the reason is, such a high percentage of us live, 80% of Americans live in counties that have had federally declared disasters in the last couple of years. At this point, it's like, you know, who are you going to believe, Exxon or your own lying eyes, you know?
And Larry Schweiger, you, of course, being with the Wildlife Federation, focus on the wildlife issues. Biodiversity is one of the primary effects that we're seeing. How bad is that?
Well, the scientists have some time ago actually identified that if we continue to heat the planet up, we could see somewhere between 30 and 70% of the total species on the planet either extinct or on the road to extinction in the next several decades. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, that we need to be really paying close attention to. You know, it's pure hubris to suggest that we can somehow throw half the species off the planet without having an enormous impact on human populations. So it's a real threat. We're seeing some of that already. You know, ecosystems are in real stress conditions. Bill talked about the oceans. We're also seeing estuaries warm up, having greater dead zones as a result of high temperatures and pollution. We're seeing in other places as well. Moose, for example, are on the decline because they are much more of a cold weather species, and as it warms up, they have a harder time. So we're seeing wildlife already reacting. In fact, they've been reacting for literally decades. Rachel Carson wrote about it in 1950, and she saw some of the early signs of change. And so wildlife are going to be one of the things that are impacted early in the process.
So while we're talking here, of course, we know that one of these climate conferences is going on. Larry Schweiger, you suggested that it is not particularly effective. What are you seeing coming out of there, and why do you think that it's not having any effect, and do you think that with things like Sandy, maybe it will start to progress?
Well, first of all, the U.S. government needs to take these international conferences seriously. They need to step up with real proposals, and we need to have everyone participate together. But at the end of the day, if you make agreements and you don't live up to those agreements, and we haven't been, we need to have a mechanism to have enforcement and have a way to hold people accountable for their promises. We've seen the total carbon emissions actually increase last year, despite the years and years of conferences that have been held. So it's time to get serious. It's time to quit talking and start doing. And it's time to create a mechanism for holding each other accountable.
Now, there does seem to be some shifting from some of the manufacturers of doubt, as we call them, the deniers of the science. Is it significant yet, Bill McKibben?
Well, I think that there's a few sort of signs that things might be they might be starting to have a little bit harder time getting away with what they're doing. The CEO of Exxon this summer actually said what his predecessors had always refused to say, that climate change was real. But the minute he said it in a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations, he immediately said, but of course it's an engineering solution with engineering problem with engineering solutions. And he went on to propose the solution that we move our crop production areas to other parts of the world, which if you think about the fact that we already have farms every place that there's soil, isn't a very good engineering solution. In fact, there are no engineering solutions. The only solution is to stop these guys from pouring carbon into the atmosphere, turn them from fossil fuel companies into energy companies. But that won't happen as long as they're making money at the scale they are now, as long as there's not a price on carbon. In order to get that, we have to reduce their political power somewhat. So we've launched divestment movements as of today on 100 campuses around the country, and lots more actions like that to come. we need to make people understand that these guys are the new tobacco industry. Instead of taking people out one individual at a time, they're going after us, you know, one planet at a time, and they need to lose their kind of social license to do that.
Well, given the re-election of Barack Obama, and Larry Schweiger, you had said in another article that these elections really did open a window for politics of the environment. Do you see at this point a shift in leadership from the U.S., either on the international scale or on the national scale?
Well, we have been hearing from President Obama that he is going to take up climate in his second term, and he's going to deal with the fiscal cliff first and then deal with the climate issue. And I don't think they have their game plan done yet. I think they are still looking for the right pathway. And I think it's up to us right now to help frame up that new pathway for them, to show them what needs to be done. We need to find a way to cut at least 5% a year to get us to a safe harbor. And if we're not coming up with bold enough plans to achieve that, we're not really solving the problem, because what Bill's talking about, the carbon bomb that's in the north, is being released, and it will continue to be released so long as we're putting more carbon in the sky. We're going to accelerate that. It's like putting gasoline on a fire. So we're adding to that each year, and so it's accelerating that natural melt that's occurring. Not natural, but the natural landscapes are melting now, and that is a very, very dangerous thing. So I think it's important that we make clear to our elected officials that this is an urgent matter. It's not something we can kick the can down the road. It's not something we can take small bites out of. It's something we need to face very aggressively and very responsibly.
So how do we reduce that 5%? Bill McKibben, is there something being put forward by your organization?
Sure. I mean, look, the first rule of holes is when you're in one, stop digging. And in this case, it's literal. We'll find out if the president's serious at all about this stuff when he makes the decision about whether or not to permit this Keystone pipeline down from the tar sands of Canada. If he lets it go through, that's 900,000 barrels of oil a day that would otherwise have stayed in the ground. That exactly to the barrel almost wipes out the savings that come from the one good thing he's done, increasing automobile mileage standards. And this is something he can do without asking John Boehner or Mitch McConnell or anybody else. He gets to make the decision, and we'll find out. I mean, I think it's the purest litmus test, and I got to say, it's also been the great moment for the environmental community in recent years to see the grassroots youth activists come together with our really powerful organizations like NWF, like the Natural Resources Defense Council or the Sierra Club. For the very first time in a long time, people are united in a serious way, and if we lose on the Keystone Pipeline, I fear that will shatter. And if we win on it, I think it's this has created the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country. 1,253 people went to jail, put their bodies on the line, stopped that thing. If we win this fight, then we have the movement that can go on to do a lot more.
It seems to me, speaking with scientists that we do on our scholar circle, that there are already designs that could power the entire world with renewables, and that they're the only obstacle that they argue is really a political obstacle. It's not economic. It's not materials. That it can be done by 2030. And with President Obama's first administration and with Stephen Chu as the Secretary of Energy, it seems like he started down that path with the stimulus. Would it make sense to then just take what Stephen Chu and the stimulus started and multiply it? Bill McKibben, why don't you take it first?
Yeah, look, the answer to this question is one word long, and that answer is Germany. The Germans are the one big country that tried to take this seriously. Their energy minister and the conservative government of Angela Merkel said 2 weeks ago that they were going to blow past their target of 33% renewable energy by 2020, which would have been way ahead of the rest of the world. He said, we're going to be at 50% and closing in on 66%. There were days this summer when Germany generated more than half the power it used from solar panels within its borders. And this is Germany, okay? I mean, Munich is north of Montreal. They don't have California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Florida to, you know, pad their statistics. It's proof that there's not any technological barrier to doing what needs to be doing. The barrier is entirely a barrier of political will, and we just have to get down to it. We have to decide we're going to spend the money, do the work, and get it done.
Now, the fact that neither of you went to the conference in Qatar signifies that you're not expecting the U.S. to sign on to anything. At the same time, we have some of the other countries that are major emission releasers, such as China, also resisting. Can the U.S. do it alone? Larry Schweiger.
Well, I think personally that I believe for a long time that if the U.S. steps up and commits to a serious plan and puts the legislation in place, that will be a very strong signal to countries like China, like some of the other major emitters, and to you know, to send that bold signal is what really needs to be done. And you know, we have you know, most of the carbon dioxide in the sky is sadly ours. The Chinese have now become greater emitters than we are, but clearly we need to lead the way. And as Bill points out, the technology is there. The problem with just a stimulus program alone is, unless you have the demand by putting a price on carbon or by some other mechanism, you're not really going to get the transformation that needs to occur. For example, there's all sorts of subsidies for fossil fuels today, and those minor subsidies for wind and solar, are particularly wind right now, are disappearing, and the wind industry is dying. I mean, you know, you take Vestas Wind, for example. Their stock went from $42 a share. Now it's down to less than $2 a share. And the reason for that is that there's little hope in the minds of investors that that we're going to really do the right thing and give wind the wiggle room it needs to continue to grow. And that's a very troubling thing, because here we are on one hand looking at the world overheating. We're seeing enormous damage from fires and floods and droughts and terrible superstorms. And we're doing the very things that will actually cripple the industry that will get us out of this ditch. And so in my mind, we have a very serious policy failure here, and one that needs to be addressed.
Larry's just right. We're doing exactly the opposite of Germany. We're, whatever you spell Germany backwards, that's what we're doing right now. And he's also absolutely right that we've got to work around the world to make it happen. 350.org works in 191 countries, every country but North Korea. We're going to convene a summit in Istanbul in June with six or seven young people from each country on Earth. And what they're going to do there is tell the UN what they actually have to be doing, instead of the insipid talk shop that they've been operating for the last 20 years on this issue. Young people are going to say, here's what needs to happen. Here's the numbers. Here's how it works. And do our best to shame them some. See if we can get them to work somehow or another. Because right now, nobody's doing it. Not Washington, not Beijing, not any place.
And are there innovative ideas that are emerging, either from your allies in Congress? I know some cities and counties are trying to take things on. Some states are taking things on. Larry Schweiger, why don't you take that?
Well, I think that there's been a number of wonderful examples of cities and states that have taken bold action. I think the I'm here in California right now, and the good work that's happened in California and the willingness to stay with an aggressive carbon reduction plan is really a great model for us to look at. And if you look at cities, for example, Chattanooga is replacing all of its streetlights with LEDs that will also allow for other benefits to the community and save about 80% of the energy that they're spending, and do it in a way that both protects the environment, makes their life actually better. And so I think there are examples, you know, from top to bottom of what we can do. It, as Bill said earlier, it's not the technology, it's not the capacity, it's a willingness, it's the political will. And that's what's flawed. And the reason it's flawed is because behind every politician that's denying climate, there's an oil company or a coal company standing there with a bag full of money. And I think we should just call it out the way it is. These folks have been taking money from the polluters to get reelected, and they are going to dance whatever song that they want them to dance to. And Bill, that's what we're seeing.
Bill McKibben, anything you'd like to add to that?
No, look, Larry is, as always, thought about this longer and deeper than just about anyone. Our problem is the fossil fuel industry, above all, and so we're just going to keep we'll keep talking about it, but we're doing all we can to do more than talk. We are trying to organize just as fast as we can, and it's not just 350. It's everyone. I had the pleasure of being down in Georgia the other day and met one of NWF's great organizers, a young woman named Erica Williams, at one of the working for them down there. And you know, I just, like, she was so emblematic of the young people all over this country and all over this world who we get to see every day, who are doing the right thing, starting to put the pressure on. My fear is that we're very short on time. We have to do this with such speed that it's going to take real commitment, and so far we don't see much more than token commitment, even out of people that we've supported, like the president.
And I know, Bill McKibben, speaking of time, you need to go. I'm going to let you
go on stage here. Yes.
What? We're going to let you go. And Larry Schweiger, I have one last question for you.
Sure.
That is,
good luck, Bill.
And that is, with the BP settlement that just occurred, do you think that was fair?
That is hopefully just a down payment on what BP will ultimately pay. You know, they have not paid the penalties under the Clean Water Act. And you know, when you do the math on that, we're talking, you know, upwards of $40 billion of liability based on the amount of pollution that they put into the Gulf of Mexico. And there's actually clear penalties in the act for these spills. And, you know, they need to pay up, and it's time that they pay their full price. And I should say that that money, 80% of it, will be used back in the region to largely to restore the coastal damage that's been done over the decades, as well as to help nature recover from the enormous pollution load that's been put into the Gulf of Mexico. So we think it's just a step, but not the full responsibility.
Well, Larry Schweiger, thank you so much. And I know we've lost Bill McKibben already, but we'll thank him publicly as well. And we'll have you back very shortly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Larry Schweiger is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation and the author of Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. Bill McKibben is best-selling author of numerous books, including The End of Nature and Earth. He's also the founder of 350.org, an organization dedicated to solving the problem of climate change. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud, and if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Just a reminder that you're listening to Background Briefing. I'm Maria Armudian. I'm host of the Scholar Circle, but I'm sitting in for Ian Masters, who is taking a well-deserved vacation. President Obama is putting pressure on Congress to reach a deal on debt, both from inside and outside of Washington. Both the president and Congress are working to avoid what they call the fiscal cliff. But some economic scholars say this so-called fiscal cliff is not what we should be most worried about. We have with us James Galbraith and George Zornick. James Galbraith is a professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of numerous books, including The Predator State, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. George Zornick, who also joins us, is the nation's Washington reporter and was a senior reporter at thinkprogress.org. Welcome to you both. George Zornick, I would like to start with you to give us an update about the latest with the negotiations on this fiscal cliff.
Sure. I would say there were two significant developments inside Washington today. Actually, one development happened outside of Washington and one inside it. What happened outside of Washington in Pennsylvania is that President Obama traveled to southeastern Pennsylvania and met with some middle-class people who would benefit from having that the Bush rates below the $250,000 bracket extended, and he held a press conference. And this is part of his tour to kind of take his case in campaign mode to the American people to try to apply public pressure to Republicans and moderate Democrats and Republicans to go along with his fiscal cliff plans. So that's something I think we can expect to see a lot more of going forward. And the other significant development I think that happened in Washington last night was that Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma, a very conservative member, stepped up and said, listen, the Republicans should just accept a bill now that extends the Bush tax rates on the bottom 98% of earners and fight about the top 2% later on down the road, January, February. And this is something that basically the White House has been urging Republicans to do and for Cole to step up and say that, and in fact, when he said it, he said that there were numerous unnamed Republican colleagues of his who agreed that could possibly suggest some weakening on the Republican side towards those rates. So those, I would say, are the two main developments that have happened today over this issue.
So increasingly, Republicans are abandoning this pledge that they gave to Norquist.
Well, I don't want to say that necessarily based on one guy, but I think the things that we've seen over the past few days from a small handful of Republican leaders might indicate that they're at least kind of softening. Although, really, Cole's position would not violate Norquist's pledge. He's just saying, let's extend the tax rates on the bottom 98% of earners. He's not saying, let's raise them on the top 2%. He's just saying, let's decouple this argument so that we can get more leverage, essentially, because the White House is holding this over them as leverage, that the extension of the middle class tax cuts. And I think he's actually right there. They would probably improve their position strategically were they to do that.
Before we get into the analysis of what this so-called fiscal cliff means, I wanted to get a sense of what are the parameters of each of the arguments and where the standoff is. I know that the tax rates on the $250,000 and up earners is one of the areas. So is health care. What are the other issues that they're fighting about now?
Well, there are several. One I think is the level of changes to health care programs. I mean, both say that they want to change them, but Democrats, for the most part, and much to my surprise, are kind of holding the line on not cutting benefits to people who use Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. They're willing to cut the programs and cut the expenditure some, but they, for the most part, are saying we don't want this to affect beneficiaries. So whether that will happen and the extent to which it will is certainly one sticking point. Another area is on the spending side, and this isn't a very sexy issue and as compared to the tax cuts and the entitlement programs, if one can consider that sexy. But, there is this defense sequester, which is going to happen. Republicans desperately don't want to see that level of money taken from the defense budget. And besides from that, there are a certain level of domestic side cuts that no one is really paying attention to that would probably be fairly devastating to a lot of the domestic and social spending that the government does. And that's certainly going to be a point of contention as well. Beyond all that, you have a payroll tax cut, which is expiring. You have unemployment insurance, which is expiring. You have an alternative minimum tax, which is expiring. You have a doc fix to Medicare, which is expiring. So there are all these other issues that the parties are going to be trading and horse trading over. And then on top of all of that, you have Republicans starting to make a little bit of noise about the debt ceiling, which, as far as we know, we'll probably be hit in December or January, though the Treasury could play with a deadline. But that's something that Republicans are starting to kind of threaten to take hostage once again if they don't get their way in these ongoing negotiations.
James Galbraith, let's bring you in now. You've been studying these issues for years. You suggest that this so-called fiscal cliff is not really so alarming, but it's being used as an alarm to change some of these programs. What are the realities?
Well, the phrase fiscal cliff is basically a public relations device to try and put political pressure on members of Congress to come up with some kind of a deal, a so-called grand bargain, in the period between now and the end of the year. And from that point of view, it's a gross exaggeration, to say the least, because not much changes within the first few days. I mean, obviously, tax rates change and so forth, but the effect on the economy of such changes is drawn out over time. If these issues were not resolved, if tax rates were allowed to go up dramatically and persisted for 6 months or a year, then you would see a real crimping on people's budgets. But if it happens for a few weeks and action is taken in the new Congress rather than the old one, effects on the underlying economy are essentially trivial. So the pressure is being certainly placed on people to come up with some kind of a bargain and to enact it in this Congress. But at the same time, I think a great many people in the Senate, particularly where the hand of the Democrats going to be strengthened by in the new Congress, are saying, well, just exactly why is it that we should be panicked into a bargain right now? On January 1st, the Bush tax cuts have expired at that point, and the decision to introduce a offsetting tax reduction for 98% of taxpayers becomes it's hard to see how that's a difficult legislative decision to take in the first weeks of January.
So the Congressional Budget Office was where the warning allegedly came from, and it had said there's a concern about dipping into another recession and unemployment going up should they miss the deadline.
No, the CBO study was over on the effect of the fiscal cliff if the policy changes that happened in the 1st of January persisted for 6 months or a year. I think actually the study covered a year's time frame, but that's not a reasonable expectation. There's no reason why the Congress can't fix everything in January rather than December.
So really what happened is that the CBO put out a study about all the various policy effects over time, and it became shoved into a short time frame.
I think that's essentially correct. And the real danger here is that in the course of trying to get past this artificial deadline at the end of the year, there may be decisions that would be very deleterious to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid over a long time horizon, over 15, 20, or 30 years. A decision, for example, to change the way in which Social Security benefits are adjusted for the cost of living could end up substantially impoverishing the very elderly in 10 or 20 years' time. That's the kind of thing that I think we have to be worried about if there were a kind of high pressure environment in which Democrats were being asked to sign up to a deal in the last days of the year.
Let's talk a moment about that, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, because the framing of it coming from the Republican leadership is really this fear of insolvency, this fear of China owning our debt and not being able to...
Yeah, this is all nonsense.
Well, this is why I wanted you to explain what the reality is.
I mean, the reality is that Social Security is a social insurance program. What it does is spread the burden of caring for the elderly and survivors and dependents and the disabled from their immediate families who may or may not be able and willing to bear that burden to the whole working population. That's the way the system works. And at the same time, it also says if you're a working person, you pay in whether you've got your own parents to support or not. That's a burden-sharing arrangement which has been going on for 70 years now. It's perfectly viable. There is no, it's not a money-making arrangement. It's not a business. If the government ended up paying out more for a period of time than it takes in payroll taxes, the government doesn't go bankrupt as a result of that. So there's a great deal of scaremongering, frankly, propaganda associated with Social Security, and it comes from people who don't like the program. The program has had enemies ever since it was begun. Those enemies have a lot of money to throw around. The Peterson Foundation, for example, has been doing this for a long time, and they are constantly come up with unfounded scare stories. In the cases of Medicare and Medicaid, you have, again, social insurance programs, which basically apply to particular parts of the population, the elderly and the poor, people who meet a certain asset test in the case of Medicaid. If you target those programs under this very misleading rubric of the word entitlements, then what you're doing is you're saying we're going to cut back on the elderly and the poor. But the real problem in healthcare is not the elderly, the poor, it's healthcare costs in general. And the way to deal with that problem is to take measures that bend the cost curve, so to speak, that bring down the cost of providing healthcare services, not just for the people who are covered by government insurance, but also for the people who are covered by private insurance, and for that matter, for the people who go to the emergency rooms. And one of the things the president's program, the Affordable Care Act, was intended to do was to try and relieve some of that burden of cost. That's the right way to approach it, to take healthcare as a problem that has to be dealt with as a system, not as a problem of the government's budget, which it isn't.
Well, let's ask George Zornick now. Are you hearing any change in this rhetoric that Professor Galbraith is talking about right now as the debates are going on around this?
Yes. I think there's there's hundreds, literally, of fiscal cliff stories published every day in D.C. And I think if you cut through a lot of it, basically what's happening is absolutely nothing. Each side is modifying their rhetoric a bit to seem essentially more open to compromise than they probably actually are. That's certainly happening on the Republican side with talking about Norquist's pledge and the few that have said they're willing to break it. You have Democrats saying that they're open to changing entitlements, which some of them very well may be. But a lot of this is just kind of pre-posturing to make themselves appear, heading into when the actual negotiations start, to be totally reasonable and open-minded, and to portray the other side as obstinate and inflexible. You have a deadline coming up in about 3 weeks on December 21st when Congress is supposed to leave Washington. And in the few days before that, if past history is any guide, is when the actual negotiations will start. So watching the rhetoric now, I think you have to take it all as kind of dime a dozen and realize that no one is actually negotiating with each other yet, but instead kind of negotiating for a public image as a reasonable party to this deal.
Yeah, I think that's right, that what you're seeing now is that great art form, the bad faith display of good faith, which the optimist in me says that it really is all in bad faith and that there will be obstinacy and no deal on December 21st. What I worry about is that somebody will try to make a political hay out of having come to a bargain at the cost of programs that are really valuable to large parts of the population.
So if we were going to look at what some of these various case scenarios could be, James Galbraith, you had laid a few of them out. You talked about what could happen with the military and what could happen with discretionary federal spending. What's your take on the potential results here?
Well, I think the one area, and I think George mentioned this in his introductory remarks, that we should worry about if there's no arrangement to defer it, are disruptive cutbacks in essential federal services in the new year. One can think about, for example, the Federal Aviation Administration. Can it maintain all the air traffic control centers on the budget that it will have? All of these agencies will, of course, be trying to maintain services on the assumption that the problem will be resolved and they'll get the money that they need in sufficient time. So things will not happen immediately. But if there's a big delay, then those sequesters could bite those services. The military, I'm not worried about. There's just a ton of money there, and the needs and demands are coming down anyway, so the military can handle its side of the sequester. There's no cause for panic there at all. And as I say, on the tax side, maintaining demand for and maintaining the incomes of the middle class is something that can be handled in due course. It shouldn't be allowed to go too long, but if it happens in January or February, the middle class will have come through Christmas. It won't be in a position where it's going to run out of money because of shopping demands in January. So I think the real issue is that there will be some real discomfort. People who lose unemployment insurance, that's a problem that should be dealt with. Let me think. The payroll tax and holiday, which is not on the table, nobody expects that to be extended, but that will bite into middle class and working class incomes for sure. But I think that's basically something that can't be avoided at this point.
George Zornick, let's go back to you for just a bit and look at the latest developments with Timothy Geithner. What is the significance of him going to meet with leaders?
Well, he's been, although the White House won't fully admit it, he seems to be kind of the point person in negotiating a lot of this deal. And I think it's something that's worrying to a lot of progressives, and rightly so, because he's a guy who whose resume is not one that would suggest he's going to be overly sympathetic or understanding to some of the things, you know, like the domestic side services, like Medicaid, like the safety net. You know, that's just not his experience. He's a Wall Street guy. He's a big picture guy. He's someone who I think is going to be much more sensitive to bigger and mainly trumped up concerns about the deficit than he will be to, you know, preserving discretionary non-defense spending in the U.S. So I think that's something that's giving progressives a lot of heartburn and probably rightfully so.
It could potentially be strategic, though, for Obama to send Geithner, the closest to the conservatives and the Republican Party of all of his go-to people. Would you say that could be it?
Sure, that's certainly possible, and I think there's a tendency on all sides to kind of overanalyze things when during this period when not much is in fact happening. And I think the other thing is that ultimately, I think we can assume that the prerogatives of the president will be carried out in these negotiations. So what he and his close team decide to do are basically what Geithner will push for, and you know his resume and his personal inclinations may not be all that huge of a factor.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this situation, and George may have some insight onto this, is that we don't really know after all of this time what the gut instincts of the president really are on this matter, which way he will turn. Will he stand to defend the basic safety net and social insurance program, or will he go along with some proposal that basically in some subtle way undermines them? I don't think we really know at this point. I think that, as George said, progressives have some anxiety about this. But it really is remarkable. The president's been president for 4 years, and there are still, let's say, doubts and questions.
Although he has indicated during the campaign process that he would stand, it sounded to me, in my interpretation anyway, he'd stand pretty firm on the issues of Medicare and Medicaid and that sort of a thing. Was that your interpretation as well, James Galbraith?
I think it's hard to say. In the first debate with Governor Romney, he made some comments about Social Security, about how their positions were not very far apart, which were truly frightening. The problem here is that everybody wants to represent to the public that they're defending Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the other core social and protections that we have. But they can do that and at the same time allow, let's say, appears to be a technical adjustment to go into the law, which undermines them over 20 or 30 years. And that is the thing that really should not be allowed to happen in the next 3, 4, 5 weeks.
And I guess finally, what I'd like to just touch on is this aspect of mass media as well as the social media, because it seems like the panic has been exacerbated by the way it is being framed publicly. Would you, George Zornick, would you agree with that?
I'm not totally sure. You know, that's one of the things I've been kind of curious about and unable to quantify is how closely people in the country are really following these negotiations or even understand exactly what's happening. I think, you know, after there's a tendency, I think, after the campaign season ends to just, on a lot of people's behalf, especially with the holidays coming up, to just kind of disconnect from this process. So that hasn't happened in D.C., and all the folks covering the campaign have, you know, much to the regret of their companions and family, plunged right into covering this fiscal cliff stuff. But outside in the country, I'm sensing a certain sense of disengagement or disinterest in what's happening. And part of that is just because it's very difficult to understand once you dive into, you know, a lot of the fiscal policy measures that are happening here. It's not particularly interesting.
And I think that the people are inured to this to a certain degree. They do understand that there's a big propaganda campaign going on, that this is an inside Washington lobbying operation. They are not terrorized by the idea that the country is about to go off a fiscal cliff, whatever that means. They've seen this kind of thing before, and they tend to be quite, quite level-headed about it. There's a limit to the amount you can really propagandize the American people on a matter like this. But inside Washington, inside the Capitol, as George says, it's 24/7. The lobbies who were basically preparing this before the election unleashed it on election day. You could already see it in the Wall Street Journal. I think in the New York Times there were propaganda stories, and then it's been nonstop ever since.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us and for helping us to understand this.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
James Galbraith is a professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of numerous books, including The Predator State, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. And George Zornick is the nation's Washington reporter and was a senior reporter for thinkprogress.org. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Maria Armudian. I'm host of the Scholar Circle and sitting in for Ian Masters, who's taking a well-deserved vacation. Mark Perry joins us now. He is an author and historian who specializes in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He has won both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the Project Censored Award. Welcome, Mark Perry.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you. So let's start with the Palestinian statehood vote that is going to happen very quickly. First of all, when do you think this vote will happen, and what do you expect to happen?
Well, I expect the vote to happen. It could happen as early as tomorrow. It might be kicked back a little bit, but I think the outcome is already assured. Barring, I suppose, some kind of technical glitch or some use of UN rules that I'm not familiar with, it could be postponed, but I expect that the Palestinians will win their bid and that Abu Mazen's strategy of kind of pushing the United States and Israel into a corner together and alone, with the possible exception of Micronesia and Germany, I guess, is not going to vote for it. He will win the vote. The question that remains is, if he wins the vote, what else does he win? What does it mean? I've been puzzled by the U.S. strategy on this. I think that this thing should have been done over in the past. If the United States had shrugged their shoulders and said, fine, go ahead and do it, it's meaningless, and dubbed it meaningless, then it might have been. But by opposing it so adamantly, the United States has put itself in a bad diplomatic position.
Europe is still divided. I don't think Germany is the only no vote, and I think there are some abstentions. Why are other places, including Germany, abstaining or voting no?
Well, this has been happening for a long time. European states are pulling away from the United States on straight down the line support for Israel under all and any circumstances. I'm not so sure that that's as significant or as crucial as we might believe. The United States has positioned itself as the only negotiator to this conflict.
So what I mean is, why would Germany vote no? And I understand London is saying they're going to
abstain. Yeah, I still think the same rule holds. Well, Angela Merkel Angela Merkel is the author, basically, of the Quartet Principles, wants to follow the United States on them, wants to follow the diplomatic lead of the United States, believes that this is unnecessary. I think that the UK government has a different kind of a problem. They have an actual Muslim constituency, and a rather large one, and they don't need to offend them, and an abstention is a recognition of that constituency. It doesn't offend the United States that much, and it still leaves them in the game. So for both Germany and for the UK, this is an easy decision. Germany follows the United States, and the UK follows its constituency, and it's very predictable.
So most people have been saying that this has emerged as a result of the latest Gaza occurrences. And the Palestinian side has really argued that this is showing up like a moral victory. And Israel is saying almost the opposite. Do you think that neither are accurate and are using this as political capital, or do you see it in another way?
No, I think it's a political move. Moral victories don't win wars. And Abu Mazen needs to retrieve his position in the Palestinian street, especially after the ceasefire in Gaza, which seemed to empower and gain and give stature to Hamas. This is the way for him to go to his people absent negotiations and absent a settlement freeze and fill a political vacuum and say to them, we're doing everything we can to push back against our enemies. We're doing it diplomatically and not with rockets. This will work. Give me a chance and give me time. This puts him back in the headlines, and it takes Khaled Mishal out of the headlines. Mm. It's a very good political move on his part. I'm somewhat skeptical that the Palestinian people will stand up and cheer this. I think they'll support it, and we'll see praise and we'll hear praise for Abu Mazen. But long term, it's not going to really strengthen his position. I think that Palestinian memories of this month will be of the fight in Gaza. And Hamas's clear signal that the way to get the Israelis to talk seriously is to apply some pain to them. That certainly seems to have worked in the most recent conflict.
I want to go back to that, but before we do, I want to understand what this non-member observer state status means and why they have put so many qualifiers on it.
Well, it's an interesting legal question, and I'm not an international legal scholar, obviously. But there has to be something done with the Palestinian people that gives them status as part of this conflict and part of the solution, and as an address that you need to go to. It gives them the power to appeal to the international community and to use the international community structure to put pressure on Israel. Winning this status in this vote tomorrow will mean that it can take Israel, the Palestinian Authority, can take Israel to the International Criminal Court and hold it accountable under international law for its actions as an occupying power. This is a very unusual situation because, to make an obvious comparison, when Germany was an occupying power in World War II, it was actually occupying states. And so it was governed by international law. Israel is not occupying a state, and it's claiming that it's occupying disputed territories, that this isn't a real Palestinian state, and therefore the Palestinians have no status in the international community to bring legal action against Israel. The vote tomorrow will change that. So it's not insignificant. It makes the Palestinian players in the international community because they're actually able to bring legal action against Israel for the occupation that they're suffering.
Now, at the same time, the Palestinians are being urged not to take such action.
Well, they're going to take the action. They're going to press their claims. They have no other weapon to use outside of the ones that Hamas has shown off in the last 2 weeks or so. Abu Mazen doesn't have anything to offer his people except this. So they're going to do it. They're going to go ahead and do it. If he were to cave in, if he were to say to the United States, you're right, I won't do this, he would expect something in return. What is it that we're going to give him? We couldn't impose a settlement freeze on the Israelis. We can't force their return to the negotiating table. We're not going to cut aid to Israel. We're not going to break with Israel. So what other, you know, what is it that the United States can offer the Palestinians in the near term? And the answer is not a thing. So I think that Abu Mazen sees the options open to him. This is a good option. It makes him a player again, and he's going to do it. And it could be significant. It's not going to lead to a long-term solution to this conflict, but it's at least pressing the Israelis diplomatically in a way that they haven't been before.
Do you think it affects the power dynamics within Palestine between the two major political parties?
Well, I read yesterday, and I think that the reports are accurate, that Hamas has said that it will now support Abu Mazen's initiative at the United Nations. That wasn't the case before. And I think that's a result of both Hamas and Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, are moving very quickly towards a reconciliation and working together. I don't think that it necessarily strengthens his hand inside the Palestinian Authority. But it's significant that Hamas would come out and support his initiative. What it means is that the Palestinians now, for the first time since the split between the two groups, are willing to work together and in coordination. And this is a vote of confidence from Hamas. They have the upper hand here after the ceasefire. So for them to come out and support the initiative is, I think, a real gain for Abu Mazen. But it shows also their willingness to move towards reconciliation. And that's a significant gain for him.
Do you expect it to also impact Hamas's attitude with Israel and meeting them at the table?
Hamas' position is that they do recognize the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, but they're not a part of the PLO. So their bid has always been, you know, bring us into the tent. Reconciliation could begin the process of their joining the PLO, and there would be negotiations on how that would be done. And they could be part of a unity government without being holding the office of prime minister or president that would negotiate with Israel. Now, Israel's already said we won't negotiate with a government that contains any Hamas members, but it's going to be increasingly difficult for them to do so, especially after having talked to Hamas, however indirectly, in Cairo. So we may be on the verge with this move tomorrow of a series of further moves that would include reconciliation, the creation of a unity government inside the Palestinian Authority between Hamas and Fatah, and the emergence of a much more comprehensive, consensus-driven initiative on the part of the Palestinians that it would be very hard for the Israelis to say no to. So I think that Hamas and Fatah, in moving towards reconciliation and this praise for Hamas of Abu Mazen and their support for the initiative in terms of Palestinian local politics, it is significant.
Well, Mark Perry, thank you so much for joining us here, and we look forward to continuing our conversation on Sunday at noon on the Scholar Circle.
My pleasure.
Mark Perry is an author and a historian. He specializes in military, foreign affairs, intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. That's it for today's Daily Briefing. I'm Maria Armudian of the Scholar Circle, sitting in for Ian Masters. Thank you to Daily Briefing producer Graham Fitzgibbon and to Scholar Circle producer Melissa Chiprin. You can hear part two of our discussion with Mark Perry on Sunday at noon, followed by a Scholar Circle on conflict resolution and building peace in Palestine and Israel.